so the meeting will come to order. Welcome, everybody, to the K-12 Education Committee for the Biennium 2000 and 2008. And we have got a wonderful, enthusiastic committee and many, many new members. And this committee is being taped and will be on television later, but anyone in the Capitol Complex can actually be hearing it right now. And so I think we want to take some time to go around and get to know each other a little bit, and this is your chance to get in a good plug for what is important to you and to share it with your district and the viewing audience, as well as our family of lobbyists out in the audience, and they would like to ID all the new members. But before we do that, I just want to say that it is my hope that this committee will be able to operate in a way that all members will be productive, and we will be bipartisan, working together on issues. Of course, we're going to have differences, but I'm hoping they will be regional differences or metro-rural differences, or how do you best think we should address the achievement gap, or what case can be made for what really works for spending our money really well, and how can you argue that? Those kind of arguments are very welcome, but otherwise I just have to say I am a former teacher. I haven't taught for 31 years, but I still remember, and I have a gavel now for my first time in the legislature. I haven't had one in the 14 years I've been here, but I really feel strongly that everybody treat everybody with respect and argue with passion, but argue politely. And I think that knowing who's on this committee, we won't have any trouble with that at all. And I'd like to start out then with introductions. And if we could, we'll do the legislators first, and then the staff, and then we will be hearing a lot more from these two on our staff when we have our education briefing for most of the committee meeting. But if we could start with our lead Republican on the committee, and then we'll go around this way with the legislators and continue on with Representative Murphy. Who's whispering? I know she'd call me if I were whispering in her classroom. And then we all end up with the vice chair of our committee, Representative Morrow, and then we'll have the staff introduce themselves as well. And by the way, if any legislators, because you're new, don't know, when we do have a treat, which we do today because it's our first day of session out in the hallway, the coffee and donuts, you can bring it into the room. So you can go out if you didn't know that and bring some back in. But stay for the introductions of all our So Representative Hyde Gerken.
Well, with that said, thank you, Representative Greiling, and you did a very nice job on television the other night of explaining where education is and where it is going. And I thought you did a very good, you have a very good vision for education. We're going to miss Senator Kelly in the Senate, and we're going to miss the meetings with him that I've had in the past. And I've been honored in the past to serve on this committee, and it's good to see the familiar faces. Representative Dabney, I'm not sitting beside you this year, I'm sorry to say, but we've had a lot of discussions over the last few years, and we've got some issues that I think you and I probably will be working together on this year as well. Representative Mariani, and I'm happy for your assignment as well. You will do very well. And I'm sure that there's issues that, again, that we can get along on. And again, I think some things that we've got to remember is that we're here for the kids. And I've always said, and I think Representative Greiling will attest to that, and I've always said that it's not Democrat or Republican. It's kids we're talking about. And I think if we can keep that keep our vision, we will do very well together and come up with a very, very good education bill and hear some good legislation. And I think we can, as I've done in the past, I'll reach across the aisle, and I hope it's reached back and forth that we've done in the past. And I know Representative Greiling and I have done that repeatedly over the years. I know she bailed me out last year in that Head Start program. And we had fun with that, but yet said that was just a small example. But with that said, I'm from Stearns County. I represent, represent Mark Wirtz here, and the troublemaker is here now. This is the guy that we get trouble with. But I come from central Minnesota, and I was a little bit late. I'm in the process of probably buying my business back at the restaurant, so we're working on that. But I represent Stearns. I've got 13 school districts. I represent Polk County, and I represent the northern half of Canyon County. All very, very rural districts. And very similar to my representative Murphy's district up there in Hermantown. All right? But that's it all. And Representative Dietrich, by the way, we were both honored in 05 together by the School Board Association. They picked one House member from the DFL side and picked one House member from the Republican side. And Representative Dietrich and I received it together, and that was very neat. We've worked together on a conference committee in the past together, so we've gotten to know each other very well. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we should just let Representative Heidegger introduce everybody. I am Representative Dietrich. I am serving my second term here at the legislature and very pleased to be on the K-12 Finance Committee. And for one of the reasons that Representative Heidegarten just pointed out is that on this committee, traditionally, we do focus on policy and finance and what is good for the children in the state of Minnesota. And most typically, we do avoid partisan politics, rural versus suburban versus urban type politics. We all are here because we have a strong passion for public education. And that is why I am so pleased to be on this committee. I represent only one school district, and I bet you're jealous. Mm-hmm. And it is the Anoka-Hennepin School District. Although it is the largest school district in the state, it has 40,000 plus students. And we are facing many of the issues that many of you are facing. And I am very pleased to be on this committee to address some of those issues. As an overall goal that I have for public education in the state of Minnesota, as I look to how can we best prepare our students for the 21st century learning opportunities that they are going to need. The world has changed. We are, our children are going to be entering a global economy, and how can we best prepare those kids for competition in a global economy. Thank you.
And I'm Representative Tom Anzels. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your introductions and your getting us off to a good start. I was last in a classroom in 1980, which is a long time ago. I was a classroom teacher from 1968 to 1980. I feel honored and that it's a privilege to be able to do my part for kids. I'm a father and a grandfather and have kids in public schools. I passionately believe in public education. It's what made most in my family what they are today, including myself. I represent Lake of the Woods, Coochiching, and a good portion of Itasca County, 8 school districts, all of which are in declining enrollment, and the free and reduced lunch figure is close to 65%. Poor kids from poor families struggling and working hard in our great public schools, and I look forward to making those schools even better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Augustine Willie Dominguez, better known as Willie Dominguez, so you can just call me Willie. I come from District 58, which serves downtown Minneapolis and the north side. I am very pleased to be on this committee of working with several entities of education. I'm a product of that education, public education, living on the north side. Some of you may know that I come from a large family of 19. I'm the 18th child, so we went through the public school system and really appreciated it at that time. What we see is declining education in the north side, a lot of dropout rate,
disparities, and those are the things that really hurt our kids, of color, especially because of the declining of dropout rate. I'm here because I'm tired of seeing it, and I hope to have some changes, but not only for the kids, but for our teachers. Our teachers are really demanding that we make some really strive in getting some resources to help them too. They cannot teach with 45 kids in a classroom. That's outrageous. And I have to say that because as we heard it the other day with both governors, Governor Al Quie and Governor Wendell Anderson's, they addressed that issue about the north side and how the dropout, and just come to the north side and see what kids are all about. And I bring that up because it really hits us, not because it's the north side, but it hits us all in the whole state. Because one time or another, those kids may move out of that north side and may move into your districts. But we want them educated. And so again, I'm really proud to be on this committee. I'm ready to work. And let's dig in, because it's about all of us. It's about all our kids. I'm a grandfather myself, and I want to make sure my grandkids get the best education they can get out of the state of Minnesota. So, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, am excited to be on this committee. My name is Robin Brown, and I am a 10-year veteran teacher now on leave of absence from my position at Albert Lea High School, one of the school districts that I serve. I'm very excited to be on the committee and do some good work for education finance. I know that we all want to do what's best for the students, and I know part of that is making sure that we can create policy that will help our local school districts support our students and do the things that they need to do. Part of my interest is in timely funding and timely finish of our work so that districts can prepare for the future school year in their calendar preparations, the hiring of teachers, their setting of schedules. Also, I have a strong interest in closing that achievement gap, as all of us do, but also looking at each of our students as individuals and making sure that each type of student is adequately funded and represented, because I know that we're dealing with so many different individuals, those who are with special needs or ELL or talented and gifted. All of these students need to be treated individually, and I would like to be a part of making that happen.
I'm Marcia Swales. I represent Woodbury, which is House District 56B. I am an AP English teacher. I currently teach at Woodbury High School. My last day of teaching was on December 20th, and I am expected to be back in the classroom on May 22nd, which is the day after Sesame. So it should be an interesting spring for me. I am just delighted to be on this committee. One of the things that I have had the opportunity, of course, as an AP teacher, is to work with our gifted and talented students over the years. And currently, I am the state advisor for the Minnesota Association of Honor Societies, and my term for that will be up in June. So I've had just a wonderful, wonderful experience as a classroom teacher, and feel that this opportunity to serve in the legislature, and particularly on this committee, is an opportunity for me to be able to have an even greater impact on the lives of our students. It is such an honor to be here, and very, very humbling all at the same time, and I look forward to the friendships that I know we're going to develop on this committee, and I look forward to your leadership, Mindy. Thank you so much.
Madam Chairman, it's an honor to be on this committee. I'm Bob Detmer. I represent District 52A, which is the Forest Lake area. And before I talk about myself, I have a student here that has shadowing me today, and David Fallhaber. If you'd just stand up, and he's out of class today, but he's shadowing me. I've had him in school at Forest Lake. My last day of teaching was also on the 22nd or 21st. I'm a 34-year veteran at Forest Lake High School, and I think I'll have more students coming down during the session that want to see what I'm doing down here. Thank you, David. With my 34 years in teaching and education, I came in the education field in 1973, and I've seen a lot of changes. And the big thing that I see is, financing our schools and making sure that kids get their education that they intend to get. But another area that's really important to me is not just the academics, but the extracurricular activities that are offered in our schools. I'm a veteran coach, wrestling coach, soccer, track, over all these years. And I get to know these students much better, many times much better in the activity areas. And we see many of these things cut from our schools over the years, or budgets cuts and so forth. And one thing that I think makes our school system so great here in the United States is that we have these programs within our schools. Kids can get involved in these programs. And it's very important that we keep these programs. Thank you.
And thanks for bringing David. And David, if you get tired of being in here, you can feel free to go out and get a donut as well. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as the other members mentioned, it's an honor to be on this committee. It's the first time I've been on K-12 finance. And so I'm looking forward to that. And, I'm Representative Paul Marquardt, and I represent District 9B, which is all or parts of Clay and Becker, Wilson, and Traverse County. And I've taught 23 years social studies there at Dilworth, Glenn, and Felton. And like Representative Detmer, and I know Representative Heidgerken, were former wrestling coaches. And
more up there.
And there's two more. There's another wrestling coach up there. And I was wondering, Madam Chair, if we'll be dealing with that wrestling bill again this year that we dealt with a few years ago. But
I hope not.
I do too, actually. But I learned something from Representative Detmer, which may not mean a lot to others outside of wrestling, but he actually wrestled Dan Gable. If you remember, the Olympic champion, he actually wrestled him one time. We're not going to talk about the result, although Dan Gable is Olympic champion. But my main goal, I guess, in all of education funding was just to make sure that the state can provide the resources to assure that we have high student achievements throughout the state. But again, it's an honor to be on this committee. Thank you.
And Representative Demmer, before you start out, it was Bernadette. I told him about one of his constituents that I met last fall, and I had to think about the right name, but she told me that I should just mention her first name and tell him what her name was, and ever after he would have to do everything I said. So it was Bernadette.
You want me to?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, are you sure it wasn't Burnett?
Burnett, that was it. Yeah.
You can tell Burnett that the message has been received.
So all of it,
and it'll be given its due consideration. Madam Chair, it's a pleasure to be here. I've had the opportunity to serve with you the last 4 years in K-12, and we've spent a lot of time together, and I think we agreed on a lot of things. We had some things we've got to discuss, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to be here. I am State Representative Randy Demmer. I'm from Hayfield, which is down west of Rochester. I represent District 29A, and that is Dodge County and western northern Olmsted County. My background, I'm a business guy is what I am. My background is, however, I served on the school board for 11 years down in Hayfield before I got in the legislature. I have had the opportunity to serve all four of my years. This is starting my third term, and all four of my years I've been in K-12 finance and K-12 policy. So this is the one committee I have been around a little bit over time, and look forward to continuing to work on behalf of the kids in the state and with all of us here. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Benson. I'm a representative in 43B, which is the northern half of the city of Minnetonka and a few precincts in Plymouth. I have a long career in education, having served 34 years in the Edina Schools system, in which I taught a number of advanced placement classes. And during that time, I came to the realization very quickly that there are There's another group of kids that we sometimes don't think too much about who need more consideration. And those are the kids who I call kind of the middle kids, the kids who show up for class, do their work. There isn't a lot for them. There are there's helps for kids who have learning difficulties or challenges, and kids like the ones I taught in advanced placement. And so I'm interested in seeing what I can do to assist this committee in seeing to it that all kids everywhere have the best possible opportunity for their education. And as I told the people in my district, and I have three school districts, Minnetonka, Wayzata, and the Hopkins schools, I see myself as a state representative as well as a representative from my particular house district. And even in districts like mine, one of which is in statutory deficit with up to 40 kids in eligible classes, 3-4 kids standing in the back of the room without desks, there are a lot of kids in this state who need assistance. And so I'm hoping to convince the other members of my committee and the public that all the school districts are in need of support and help. And intellectual capital is the most important product the state of Minnesota can produce. And every kid counts. Thank you very much.
Representative Erickson, we'll skip over to you. And what we're doing is just introducing ourselves for the committee and talking about a priority or so.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I was late. I had some visitors from Princeton, and they just now had to tell me more and more and more, so that was good. I'm Sandra Erickson, and I guess I'm starting my sixth term, although it's my 10th year. I was elected in a special, so I'm always in the middle. I also taught for over 30 years, like Representative Benson, at both the high school and junior high levels, and have served on this committee ever since I was elected, or almost. And my interest this session will be special education and ways to help our schools who have declining enrollment so that they can provide full-service curricula, maybe look more at online learning.
I'm Representative Mary Murphy, and I'm an ex officio member of this committee, but I plan on attending. I just love what you people have said, and I'm anticipating what you will have said. This is my first time on K-12 ever, and in education. When I came, my speaker, Sabo, said, "We have a teacher on education. We don't need any more." It didn't matter that there were two or three PTA presidents. It didn't matter that there were four or five or eight former school board members. But they had a teacher on, and that was plenty. I just thought that's not quite right. But in those days, we never said that kind of thing out loud. And this year is just a great experience for me, a great experiment. And I'm so excited that I'm part of it. And I think, you know, when I think I'm up for it, because I think back on my years of learning. I started in first grade. We didn't have kindergarten then. And I went to public school. My brother was a senior. I was in first grade. We met in the hallway where the lunch line was. And he might sneak me a banana for lunch in addition to what hot lunch was, depending on if he thought hot lunch was good that day or not. And same school all the way through, first through 12th grade. When I was a senior, teacher, home ec teacher, said, who had graduated from St. Scholastica, said, "Mary, what are you going to do next year?" And I said, "I don't know. I've been thinking about being an airline stewardess. and I was thinking about being a nurse. But I've always thought about teaching, too. And so she arranged for the driver's training teacher to drive me to St. Classica and meet with her friend, who was president of the college. And within the week, I had that meeting with Sister Ann Edward at St. Scholastica, and it was a half-hour meeting, and at the end of the half-hour, she said, "Well, Sue Mills said that you would be a good student for us, and so you're accepted." And so, I became a student at St. Scholastica in the fall. My tuition for the year was $135. And I made that by screwing screws in beer signs at a factory in West End Duluth. And then in the second and third year, I worked as a waitress. And the fourth year, I worked as a playground person. And when I graduated from college at the end of 4 years, without debt, without family assistance, except that I lived at home, then I started my teaching job in 1961, representative, at Clover Valley, which was a county school, St. Louis County School. And that's what really prepared me for my schedule this year. Because I was assigned 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade girls' phys. I was assigned 7th, 8th, and 10th grade health. I had 10th, 11th, and 12th grade social studies. I had 7th grade math and 7th grade science. But I managed to trade that science away for a study hall with the science teacher who didn't like study hall at all. And in addition to that, I had a preparation period once every other week. And so this schedule looks really good to me. And then after 3 years, I transferred to Duluth Central, and I taught at Duluth Central for 33 years, and my last year in the classroom was the spring of 1997. But I loved teaching, and I loved those kids, and you're absolutely right. Every single kid counts, and every single kid has to have some inspiration. Because otherwise, who's going to pay the taxes? Who's going to pay for our nursing homes? Who's going to pay for our retirement? I mean, it's just basic. And I think if I started all over again, though, maybe I would become a second grade teacher. Because those kids are just so enthusiastic every single day, every single minute. But I would have to be a lot younger for that. So let's go forth and do really good things. And I'm sure I'm going to enjoy your leadership.
Can I pass, Madam Chair?
Nobody ever wants to be after
I'm Carlos Smariati. From St. Paul, District 65B. And Mindy, they must have been giving out licenses when you were 15 years old. When she was 15 years old back then.
Oh, what? He must want something in the back.
I do. Yeah. I'm lining it up. I'm beginning my eighth term. It's kind of odd to hear myself say that. Of the previous seven terms, I think I've served five terms in an education committee. And part of that is because in my own personal life, education opportunities have clearly been a powerful pathway for me and for my family.
My parents came over to the States in the 50s from Puerto Rico, and I actually didn't speak English until first grade, which is interesting because in kindergarten, you talk about a motivation to learn English really quick. In kindergarten, my mom said, you know, we're polite people, so, you know, if they ask you something, mijo, you know, no hablas inglés, pero, you know, digas que sí, yes, say yes. And so teacher would come and ask me things, I'd smile politely and say yes, repeatedly. Well, the other little smart kids in the classroom figured out that that I was saying yes to everything, and this is kindergartners, okay? So they would do bad things, and then they'd blame me, and the teacher would come and ask me if I did it, and I'd smile and say yes. That happened about two or three times, and I wound up sitting in the corner in front of the whole class looking like an idiot, and I decided I'd go learn English really, really fast. So, but education for me was a powerful pathway, not so much out of the inner city of Chicago, because it was a wonderful community in many ways, but toward a much broader experience that led me up to post-secondary experiences here in Minnesota. And so, you know, I had a number of good educators who paid close attention to me, and I think their investment has paid off fairly well, and I think that that's our challenge. I can't think of anything more important that government does, frankly, than to invest its energy and resources in educating its young people. I think it's the mark of a truly civilized society to be able to do that. My district, St. Paul, I can't remember now. We were the largest for a little while. We're glad that our brothers and sisters in Anoka are now the largest because everyone can zero in on you guys. I think we're the second, maybe the third largest populated school district in the state. I have two children who are graduates from our public school system in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I have currently have a sixth grader in St. Paul Public Schools. Mary, that's that little baby you were holding in the house floor. Isn't that something? About 80% of our kids in Minneapolis St. Paul Public Schools are kids of color. I think it's the same number in Minneapolis, actually. We have a ton of languages that are spoken as native languages. I can't even remember. It's dozens of households, dozens of language in households. So the education of students in St. Paul in many ways is the education of a global reality. And as I get around the state, I'm finding that that's less and less unique to places like St. Paul and Minneapolis, that is in fact becoming very much the norm in all corners of Minnesota. And so I'm really hopeful that in many ways that means that we have even more reasons to find common ground in pursuing good education policy and good education investment. My top issues are the quote-unquote achievement gap issues, and then it's a term I don't necessarily like, but everybody uses it, so I know what it means. It's about the fact that we have educational disparities, unfortunately, to a large degree based on race and income, and to some degree based on geography in this state. And I think we're a better people than to continue to accept that. And I think we're smart enough people to figure out a way to not have those kind of disparate outcomes in education in our state. Many of you know that I work with the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership when I'm not here in session, and sometimes when I am in session. And we spent a good number of years really teeing up for public consumption and understanding educational disparity issues. And Madam Chair, I'll be sharing our report with you so you can share it with the committee in the coming days. Another important issue to me related to that is doing whatever we can to ensure that we have high quality standards in the state, and that we constantly review those and really push the quality benchmark And I think what underpins that for me is a strong cultural expectation in the state of having high expectations for all students, regardless of their income, their geography, or their race or language. So educational equity issues are vitally important to me, and I'm real pleased to hear that that seems to be a strongly shared value among these committee members. I look forward to working with all of you. Thank you.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that it's really fair to first have Representative Murphy and then Representative Mariani and now me. It's
kind of
going downhill as it goes. You're in a much better position. Pardon me. Starts up again after this. I'm Representative Jim Dabney, represent part of South Minneapolis, entering my fourth term. I've been lucky enough to serve all of my three previous terms on this committee and on the education policy committee as well. Fits very well with my passions. I'm a product of the public schools. I've got my oldest one, my daughter is in the public schools, and I teach in the public schools. I'm the junior member, having only 16 years. I represent part of Minneapolis, but those 16 years have all been teaching in Greater Minnesota in the Buffalo School District, and having been active previous to my arrival here on statewide education issues, I like to think I bring some perspective and some experience beyond just the central city. When I look at education issues, I think my priorities for this year are the ones that they have been for the last 6 years, and that's adequate funding for all school districts in the state. Maybe even better, adequate funding for all school students in the state would be a better way to think about it. I think we can also come forward with some targeted investments that can really go after that achievement gap, to use that phrase, Representative Mariani. Early education, and those early school years, I think, are critical, and there's some good work we can do there, and other efforts that simply provide opportunity for all students, and that will be a lot of my focus this year here. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tim Faust. I'm from District 8B, which is all of Kennebec County, southern half of Pine County, and a little bit of Isani County. And I'm very excited to be on this committee because K-12 finance is such an important thing to my district. We basically have six schools in my district, and one of them is currently in statutory operating debt. Two more have told me they will be within a year or two if something doesn't change. And so we need to change this to help all the kids. I think the kids in my district deserve the same opportunities as they do everywhere else, and that's what I'm here to fight for. When I graduated from college, I was competing with kids from South Dakota for jobs. When my kids graduate from college, they'll be competing with kids from South Korea for jobs. And the only way they're going to be able to compete with them is if we give them and provide for them the best education in the world. And so that's what I'm here to work to accomplish. So thank you.
I'll try to be brief. I'm Representative Carol McFarland from White Bear Lake, District 53, representing the White Bear School District and a small part of Moundsview. I'm a product of the White Bear Schools. My three children are, and I have three grandchildren, two in elementary school and one in early childhood. I've been a volunteer in our school district for 25 years. The last 6 years, I've served on the White Bear School Board, which I feel, being a school board member, which those who have been understand that you learn a little bit more of the overall picture about policy and finance, and make those tough decisions. I found it quite interesting that this year in the election, two of our school board members got elected to the legislature, one Senate, one House, and yet we lost the levy. So I don't understand how that works. At our last meeting,
we wanted you to fight for state funding.
I think that's exactly right. One of our last duties, though, was to approve $2.5 to $3 million worth of cuts this next year, and if the levy doesn't pass next year, another $10 million. So that's another good reason to be here. I'm a person of passion and of fairness, and I truly believe that all children in the state of Minnesota deserve a quality education. And so, and also I have a special interest in the suburban schools with declining enrollment.
My name is Pat Garofalo. I'm from Farmington. The district I represent includes portions of Lakeville as well as rural Dakota and Goodhue counties. And Madam Chair, I was very excited to be on this committee, very excited. until I got my agenda for this hearing. And God is my witness, I'm not making this up. There's a sixth item added to my agenda, and it says, resolution that Pat Garofalo is a big fat idiot. So if someone was having fun with me, I suspect it's not a Democrat, though. I think it's someone from my side of the aisle. But the joke's on them because they misspelled my last name. Now, I'm entering my second term, so of course now I'm in a position to be bestowing advice on the more junior members of the committee. But in all seriousness, I would recommend, this is something that that House staff put together. They did a really good job on this, financing education in Minnesota. And it's before the election, I made a point of trying to study up on this because I suspect that I might be on the or I was going to be requesting to be on the K-12 Education Committee. And it really is, it's fascinating. It's a little dry. I'm not going to, certainly not sexy or that really exciting, but it really does a good job of taking what is an extremely complex funding formula and describing it to members. And I would really encourage not only just first-term members, but all members of the committee to try to read through that to learn more about the individual categoricals in addition to the equalization programs that exist out there. Unlike many districts in the state, mine is a fast-growing area. There's two new high schools that are going to be built in a five-year time frame, Lakeville South, as well as Farmington High School. So we're a district that's exploding in size. And I guess the thing I most want to do from this receive from this committee is knowledge, and that is to listen and to learn. You know, when you read through this, you realize that things are really complex, and this is not a partisan committee. There are committees in the legislature that are partisan in nature, but I view transportation and education as truly bipartisan issues, and I really hope that I get to continue in my second term what I hope I did in my first term, and that is work well with members on the other side of the aisle. So with that, I look forward to the things I'm going to learn from this committee, and hopefully, I think if we were to develop a motto for the committee, I would say the motto should be that we shouldn't be afraid to try. And that if, whether it means an experiment or pilot projects or promoting things that work or stopping things that don't work, we shouldn't be afraid to try. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Will Morgan. I represent Burnsville and Savage, parts of Burnsville and part of Savage. I live in Burnsville, and I also teach in one of the school districts that I represent, Burnsville and Savage School District. I also have parts of two other school districts, the Lakeville School District and the Rosemont-Thapa Valley-Egan School District in my legislative district. I have been teaching for, actually, this is my 16th year, so I think Representative Dabney, you and I share the young pup status on this committee at that level, so I'm glad to see I'm not the only one. I'm very excited to be here. I feel that my experience will enable me to help make a real contribution on this committee, and I look forward to hearing from all the other perspectives of all the other people who have such great experience across the state in education, whether it's in the classroom or in support of the classroom. I think it's a wonderful makeup on this committee. I really see two challenges and two goals that I have for us. One of them is broad, and that is that we need to find ways to provide the resources to school districts across the state who have to meet the needs of a broad range of students with a broad range of needs and interests. And that's a huge challenge. A more focused challenge that I think we have is how can we provide opportunities for teachers in the classroom to learn about and get training on and follow best practices to help each individual student, to challenge them to high standards, and give each and every one of them the opportunities to have success. Because that's what every parent wants for their kids, and that's what we as a state should want for each and every child across the state. So I see that as our two big challenges, and if that seemed oversimplified, it was, because it's very daunting, and I think all of us here know that. So thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. And just speaking, I sat at that point with a number of the committee members sitting on this side as I came to testify for the St. Peter's School District over the past few years on many of the issues that we talked about today. So it's in some ways gratifying and also a bit alarming to be on this side of the table now. I served as St. Peter's School Board Chair and also as the Chair of the Minnesota Valley Education District, which provides special education for seven school districts. So adequacy of funding, special education funding, are two primary issues of concern to me. And the long-term tail to getting to here was when then Governor Ventura came to tour St. Peter after the tornado, and he had just announced a state takeover of the general formula, and I asked the apparently impertinent question of how are you going to pay for it, and received a rather harsh response. And then I started attending school board meetings and started reading the very book you just referred to. So I'm very excited to be here, very excited to work with everyone here. One other area of interest I would just mention is early childhood education. Coming from the same district as Senator Hottinger, and also the St. Peter district, this fall will be opening an early learning center in cooperation with MSU Mankato, Gustavus Adolphus, the school district and the city, to try to improve early childhood education. So I'm very excited to see what we can do on our end to help out.
Representative Dietrich. Thank you, Madam Chair. Deborah Hillstrom has another commitment right now at this time, and she asked that I take a moment to introduce her, but she will also be serving on this committee, and it's the first time she is going to be on an education finance committee. Representative Hillstrom asked that I just mention a few things about her district. Her district is facing some unique challenges right along with situations like many of you described. She represents the Brooklyn Center School District. They are experiencing declining enrollment, and they have seen 3 failed levies consecutively. So she has a real strong interest in seeing how this process works and seeing what we can do to make sure that the state does pay for their fair share of education funding and not dependent on local property taxes when the taxpayers are not willing to take that on. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that anybody who's, you know, here or watching this on television now knows that we have a very passionate team that will be fighting here in the legislature for our students. And if I were a teacher, I'd love to be teaching a class like this with so many eager people that are. I think it's going to be probably my favorite committee I've ever served on, never mind that I'm finally getting the chair. And now we will go around and the staff can introduce themselves, and I'm sure, being they're not elected officials, this will go a little faster. And we will start with our pages who are over in the corner in the front row, and could you come up to the table here so that your voices can be heard on the tape. And they are our temporary pages. They want to be our permanent pages, and we hope that they are. So if they're not, they will be in other committees. But they have picked us, and we would like to pick them. So if you could tell us your names and where you're from.
My name is Annette Clark, and I'm actually from St. Paul, Minnesota. And this is my first year as a page, and if anyone needs anything, just let us know. We're here to help.
And my name is Megan Swanberg, and I'm living up in Lindstrom.
Okay, well, welcome to the committee, and could you tell, because we do have so many first-termers on the committee, you know, you mentioned in that if they need help, but what are the things that you do to help the committee members?
We do a lot of preparation for the committee meetings. During the meeting, as you may have seen, passing of notes and such, and also well, we're serving coffee today and donuts. If anybody doesn't want to get up and they want us to do that for you, you can do that or anything you might need.
Okay. And we can say no if it's out of, I mean, if it's just not reasonable.
All right. Thank you very much. And then if we could go to Carmen Mayo, down there.
Carter, actually.
Oh, it's Carter. I always have called you Carmen. My gosh.
Okay. Lisa, first name didn't change. I'm Carmen Carter. I did actually.
Oh, your last name. I was going to say Carmen is what I thought. Carmen Carter. Okay.
Yeah. Poor Mindy. I guess I got married halfway through the last term. I use everyone.
Sorry about that. Easily.
Sorry about that. I'm the GOP researcher, and I actually live in Matt Dean's district up in Hugo. So.
Okay. Why don't we go to Brad Kelly, because you're the counterpart.
Hi, I'm Brad Kelly, and I'm the DFL researcher, and I live in St. Paul.
Okay, and then we'll go to Liz.
Hi, I'm Liz Mandelman. I'm the committee legislative assistant, and I actually live in Representative Marianne's district.
Back committee.
Hi, I'm Shannon Patrick. I'll be the committee administrator, and I also live in St. Paul.
I'm Greg Curl from the House Fiscal Analysis Department.
And I'm Tim Stomp from House Research.
And as you know, if you've been on other committees, the people that are to my right are work for all of us. They are nonpartisan, and House Research, of course, is for everybody, and then the fiscal staff for the committee is also nonpartisan. So we can all go to them, regardless of party, for equal opportunity, and the partisan researchers help each of us, each of our parties, with our bills. And then the committee staff is open to everybody as well to find out when things are scheduled, when things might be coming up, you know, to help us keep track of if we got a bill hearing request in and that sort of thing. I hope you will all feel equally comfortable contacting them to find out if you need any help. And then before we go to the education finance briefing and talk to the authors of these very dry publications that some others have referenced, which we really need to know, I just want to go through your committee folder. And always in the committee, you will have a handout package. And so that's all the stuff that we're discussing for the day. Then you have a save section. And you'll notice in that section, Liz has put together a handout with all of our names and pictures so we can get to know each other even more so after today. And we have the rules of the motions and how we operate committee in case you want to make any motions or fancy maneuvers. And then you've got your packet and your pens and papers. And the things that are in save will be what you want to keep at the end of the day. So when you leave, anything that's not in the save folder, whether it's in your folder or on the table, will be recycled. Only what you want to save that you put in the save folder will be kept. And then the last thing I want to go through is the committee procedures and all the rules. So many teachers on this committee, I'm sure you know that rules are there for guidelines, and if they are not working out with anything that you need to do, then please talk to me. But by and large, we would like to have the amendments for bills when we get around to that the day ahead of time, just so we can plan and make copies and everybody has a chance to think about them. But that doesn't mean we can't be flexible. So those are there. If you have any questions about them, you know, let me know. But now, and I will turn to the fiscal staff, and they will go through Education Finance 101. And they said we can ask questions as they go. They will be doing this again tomorrow, so we'll have a much, then we won't be doing introductions, so we'll have a lot more time to hear what they have to say. And then they also, I think they'll give the date and time, and the freshmen already, I'm sure, have it on the calendar, but they will be going through this even more for first termers. And any of us who are second termers or 10th termers or whatever, if we want to get even a better chance to ask questions, people that haven't been on the committee before, I suspect that the first term fiscal orientation, you would be welcome at that as well. So, Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow, it is yours.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair. You've got a packet in front of you called Overview of School Finance, School Finance, and that's what we're going to work off of. It'll be up on the screen here as well, but there is a hard copy in your packet. There are hard copies at the back. And then there are two reference guides. There are two guidebooks in your packet. You've got an outdated copy of the gray guidebook, and you'll get an updated one next time we meet there. There's an 06-07 version of that. Not too much different, but enough so that it'll make sense to place that one in your folder. All of the principles are still the same. And then you have the Blue School Finance Guidebook as well in your packet. Those have a tremendous amount of detail and computation steps for all of the formulas. So if there's something we don't go into enough detail about, or something you want to check later, or something that one of your school districts needs, usually the answer in terms of how a formula works can be found in one of those two guidebooks. We're going to try and do this overview in about a day and a half of your time. So we're going to go through things fairly quickly. Some of it will be things you've seen elsewhere. We'll try to skim through it. Please interrupt us with any questions that you ask. Much easier for us to answer them as you go. And so with that, I think we'll get started. The first thing we're going to talk about is the fiscal process, which may be a little in flux, and Mr. Crow will tell you a little about that this year.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, there are some... We had, in the past, we've provided some principles or rules relating to budgeting. We, given the state of flux of the House rules at this time, we're not 100% sure what those are going to look like. So let's just suffice it to say for this committee, basically, we have to track costs for programs that are state appropriations over 4 years. The current biennium will be appropriating money for will be fiscal years 2008 and 2009, which are the 07-08 and 08-09 school years. And then in addition, we don't appropriate the money, but we have principles that guide how we track the costs of those appropriations into the fiscal year 2010 and 2011 biennium. And so you'll see when we do tracking sheets, and we've got an example later on, that we track 4 years of appropriation costs. In addition, this committee is unique from all of the other appropriations committee in that you're responsible for keeping track of how your decisions impact local property taxes that are levied by school districts. And in a less formal fashion, you will receive a target for how much those property taxes can go up or change from current law, and we'll track those decisions the same way we do appropriations. We also do 4 years of tracking for property tax levies, but because the first year of levies for fiscal 2008 are being levied during calendar year 2007, those decisions, or all the decisions relative to those levies, have basically already been made. So you'll see, you know, the first year, the first column is fixed now, and all of the changes you make will on property taxes will only begin to show an effect in the second year of the appropriations biennium. One note on local bills that we always like to make at the beginning of session is a lot of times your school district will ask you to carry a bill that allows them to do a special levy or a fund transfer that has an impact on school levies. We track those individual school levies as part of our overall statewide school property tax levy tracking. And because of how the targets work, and we'll get into this in a little more detail when we hear local bills and fund transfers, those local levies have an impact on your state appropriation target. So, not to dissuade you from carrying bills, but if your school district, your school board, or your superintendent says, this doesn't have any cost, it's just a local levy, from our process, it does have a cost, and you should be aware of that as you're talking with us about putting those bills together, figuring out how they impact the overall budget picture. Now, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to turn your attention to Section 3, which is financing public schools. And we've got a few different charts, and I'm going to skim through the first several pages, which highlight school aid in kind of a state context. In other words, in terms of the whole state budget, we'll try and put the school aid's budget in perspective. As you all probably know, state revenue is raised in the general fund primarily through individual income and corporate income taxes, sales tax, the statewide business property taxes, and other smaller taxes. If you look at the chart on 3.3, you'll see that just kind of a breakdown of where those revenues, general fund resources, come from. Obviously, the biggest piece is individual income taxes and then sales taxes. And then 3.4 is a chart that just details the information that's in that pie graph. the general fund, money that's spent out of the general fund then is detailed on page 3, 6, and 7. The largest programs are K-12 education, healthcare, and higher education, and then you have local government aids and other smaller programs, and you see those detailed on 3, 6 in the pie chart. From that chart, you see that the budget you're dealing with is about 40% of the state biennial budget of about $32 million in the general fund. So as a committee, your jurisdiction is the single largest committee of all the committees in the House. And because of the way the committee structure is broken down, you might want to look at 3-8 and 3-6 kind of next to each other. 3-6 is kind of our breakdown of spending on a functional basis. In other words, not necessarily tied exactly to the committees. 3-8 is a description of spending tied specifically to the jurisdiction of the House committee structure as it is. So you can see there's a small difference in K-12 education versus education as a whole, and that's because some of the early childhood spending that will be covered in that's in the jurisdiction of the Early Childhood Committee is separated out on the graph on 3-8. But again, about 40% of the state budget is allocated by this committee. And 3-9 is a table that just details the exact numbers if you're interested. It shows that for fiscal 8 and 9, you're going to be appropriating, or the base budget, I should say, is about $6.4 billion, and you could be appropriating more or less than that, depending on the decisions that the Ways and Means and Finance Committees make about your spending target.
So in summary, then, you've got about $13 billion or thereabouts as your base budget that you're going to be allocating in this committee. You're also going to be allocating property taxes, and that's what the next section covers. One little note for those of you that are new to the process. Here at the legislature, you budget on a two-year basis. Many of you that have school board experience are used to the annual budgeting. Here at the legislature, most of the numbers you'll see are on a biennial basis or a two-year basis. So you're going to be making budget decisions for both fiscal 08 and fiscal 09. When you look at the property tax, the next section starting on page 310, we're going to give you just a little bit of background about that. And even though Representative Marquardt's committee is the one that has jurisdiction over some property tax matters, including the class rate structure and some other things, this committee still has a major role to play in how school property taxes look, whether additional state aid goes in to reduce those or not, and whether levies would go up by actions of this committee. So this committee pays a lot of attention and needs to have some grounding in the property tax system. There's a couple quick charts we want to show you on page 3.11. This shows the market value by property type of all the property in the state. So if you took the assessed value of all the property in the state, all the homes and all the businesses, you can see it's about $464 billion. And out of that amount, 60% of that is the residential homestead property or the houses. So the places we live essentially are about 60% of the total. Other residential property, which is mainly the non-homestead or rental property, about 10% of the total pie. Commercial industrial property, the business property, is 14% of the assessed value. Ag property, about 12%, and seasonal rec, about 4%. Keep in mind those percentages for ag and commercial industrial and turn the page, and you'll see how that property tax actually gets paid in Minnesota. And this is a deliberate decision that the tax committees in past years have been made. We use a tax system in Minnesota. We don't tax on the basis of market value. For most purposes, we use something called net tax capacity. And net tax capacity assigns class rates to property depending on the type of property. And you can see from this pie chart that there's about $6.2 billion that's going to be raised for property taxes in pay 2006. The residential homestead property, which made up 60% of the tax base on market value, pays only 47% of the property tax. Commercial industrial, on the other hand, which is the business property from the previous graph, remember they made up 14% of the tax base, but they're paying 34% of the property tax. Ag lands is just the other ratio. They make up about 12% of the base and pay about 6% of the tax on property taxes paid in Minnesota. And this is critical because as the tax committee looks at changing the distribution among tax types, these are all ratios, these class rates. If they put more or less emphasis on the property tax for business property or home property, it's going to shift how those school levies are distributed in each of your school districts. So when you look at this pie chart, anything that Representative Marquardt's committee does that moves around class rates is going to have an effect.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schramm, can you tell me, do you know what the property tax classification rates are for residential and commercial?
Mr. Schramm.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, for residential property up to $500,000, it's a class rate of 1%, and above that, it's 1.25%. So most of the home value in the state is at 1%. Most of the commercial industrial property is at 2%. And a lot of the ag land beyond the house, garage, and 1 acre, a lot of the ag land is at 0.55%. So those are there are a whole series of rates. There's about 20 different classes, and we can give you a chart that's got those listed on it. But essentially, they range from the 0.55 for the ag lands up to 2 for some of the commercial industrial property. So, Madam Chair, members, so the issue there is as we look at those tax burdens on the tax committee, we're going to shift how the distribution of school levies happens. And this, the area where this is probably of most importance for this committee is both on the debt elections and the referendum elections. As you probably are all aware, on the operating referendum elections, those go against the tax base that does not include the ag property or the seasonal rec property. However, the debt elections go against all classes of property, and for many of you that have small rural districts where they're mainly farm property, a lot of building bond issues have failed in the last few years, and in part that's because of the relative tax share that would fall onto the ag land. If you look at the recipients of that tax base on the next chart, you can see that school districts, even though, as Representative Morrow was mentioning, in 2001 there were some major changes to the aid levy mix, the school district share is already back up to 25% of the total for taxes payable in 2006. Out of the $6.2 billion, a full quarter of that goes to school districts. Counties are currently the biggest recipient of property taxes, with 32% of the property tax aid going to the counties. Cities get about 22% of the total, the townships about 3%, and there's a statewide property tax that's paid by business and seasonal rec property that's about 10%. Then there are two small categories. There are special taxing jurisdictions that have about 4% of the property tax receipts, and then there's something called TIF, or tax increment financing. That's an issue that will mainly be discussed in the tax committee, but that property is essentially off the rolls for purposes of school district funding. So in summary, on the property tax, we have a class rate system that affects how those property taxes are placed against different types of property. School districts raise a full quarter of the $6.2 billion of total property taxes. Next, let's talk about how we count students for just a few minutes. This is one of the more complicated parts of our school finance formula, or I shouldn't say complicated, one of the more confusing parts of our school finance formula. We're going to look at some enrollment trends, but first let's just talk on page 3.15 about counting students. We use a count called average daily membership. An average daily membership is essentially an FTE count of the students that are there during the year. If a student's there all year, they count at 1.0 students in average daily membership. If a student moves in the district halfway through the year, we count them for halftime for that year. We don't subtract from that count absences from school for things like illness or truancy unless it's more than 15 days. So if a student's not there for one day, even though we're an average daily membership state, we don't count that against them unless it's more than 15 days of truancy, in which case they're removed from the rolls. The next thing we do to that student count, in Minnesota, almost all our money follows the student to whatever school serves them. And that's because we have a system that has open enrollment and charter schools, post-secondary enrollment options, a whole variety of ways that students can attend different kinds of schools. And in general, nearly all of the money follows them to whatever school they attend. We use the term adjusted in context of pupils when we talk about the student that the district is actually providing the service. So when we look at a total of adjusted average daily membership, we're looking at the kids that are actually served by a particular school district or charter school. The next category that we talk about is what we call adjusted pupil units, and that's where the pupils are weighted by grade level. And there's a table on the next page that you can glance at on page 3.16 that shows those weightings. This whole business of ratings by weightings by grade level is a product of some changes in the 1990s. Up until that point in time, we simply had 1.0 for elementary kids and 1.4 for secondary kids. These weightings have been juggled around a bit in an attempt essentially to get some of the money more to the early grades And so you can see that a kindergarten kit currently counts as 0.557, so we pay just over half time for a full-time kindergarten pupil. An elementary pupil in grades 1 to 3 counts as 1.115, elementary pupil in grades 4 to 6 counts as 1.06, and a secondary pupil counts as 1.3. So when we're determining the funding for a school district, we use this concept called adjusted pupil units. We add these grade weightings to each of the students, and then we take that times the number of students served by that school district and get that measure adjusted pupil units. And unfortunately, we're not quite done yet with our pupil count. We do one more thing for purposes of declining enrollment, and that's we add the marginal concept, which is adjusted marginal cost pupil units. And essentially what we do for marginal cost pupil units is we say, if you're a district with declining enrollment, we'll give you essentially 23% of the weighting for the kids that have left the district from the previous year. So we're going to add 77% of the current year's pupil count plus 23% of the previous year's. What that essentially means is for every four kids that the district loses, we're going to replace one of them for 1 year. So if your district had 1,000 kids last year and serves 900 this year, we're going to let you count 23 kids for one more year. And that's how our declining pupil funding currently works. It's on the pupil weighting, and it's built into this concept called adjusted marginal cost pupil units. There's probably going to be, there's a lot of districts that are in decline right now. There's going to be a lot of attention, I think, this year on declining pupil counts in this committee. Couple of quick charts for you that will just flash through on enrollment trends and what's happened over time. On page 317, you can see that enrollment climbed very quickly from 1960 to 1972. This was during the height of the baby boom. We added more than 200,000 students during that 12-year period. A number of your school districts built buildings then for those students. And then you could see that starting in 1972, we had a very precipitous drop in the number of students, very quick, down to about 700,000 students again in 1985.
And we have one question. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the pupil weighting on page 316, Mr. Strom, would you please just give me just a little bit of historical thought process on why the different weighting at the different levels? What's the state's perspective on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, prior to the mid-1990s, before there were all these extra weights thrown in, the basic thinking was that secondary students cost more because there were lab costs and there were different arrangements in the high school and that kind of thing. I think the elementary teachers might disagree with that, but the weighting then was essentially a little bit to reflect the cost that school districts spent more money on the secondary kids. So at that point in time, the kindergartner counted as 0.5, an elementary student counted as 1.0, and a secondary student counted as 1.4. In the early 90s, the legislature asked the department to see how spending really was, to see if school districts were spending quite that amount at the secondary level, and it turned out they were spending less than that. So the legislature started lowering that secondary weighting from 1.4 to 1.35, and then a couple years later to 1.3. Then, in 1993, part of the Senate plan at that point in time was to try and track more of the money to the early grades. And the Senate said, instead of increasing the formula allowance, how about if we increase the pupil weights at the elementary grades to try and get more money focused on the early elementary grades? And that's where these weightings of 1.115 and 1.06 came from on the elementary level. So I think the intent of them was good in the abstract. The idea was, gee, we want to track a little more money to those elementary grades. But the process and the result was, of course, it makes it very hard to describe a pupil count because we have these seven different measures of weight depending on which grade the child is in.
And, of course, also Representative Dietrich and others, sometimes I'm sure it would be hard to imagine, but there might be occasionally a legislator who would run the formula through and see how it benefited their own district according to age of students. I'm sure that wouldn't happen very often, though.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, and then just noting that they include sixth grade in the upper elementary as opposed to the middle school, it does your accounting take into account school districts that have sixth grade in the middle school?
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, yes, it does. So we count them by individual grade, so it doesn't matter how the district is organized. It's if you've got a middle school that runs 5 to 8, that's irrelevant for purposes of how we count the money as on the funding end of it.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Cole points out that these additional class weights for the elementary, and I should have mentioned this on the elementary grades, the additional 0.115 for 1.5 for grades 1 to 3, that money is reserved and put in the special account for class size reduction, and same with the money generated from the 1.06. And the goal of that money is that, you reduce class sizes. Our current program says essentially you've got to reduce that money, reduce class size in kindergarten and first grade to a 17-to-1 ratio before you can use it in the subsequent grades. And so in some school districts, you'll find that because of the way that money is being used, you do have relatively low ratios in kindergarten and first grade, but the money's not sufficient to reduce class size much more than that at the upper grades. And, of course, there's no mandate as to what you can do with your other money to shift it around underneath it either. So the class rate, the additional pupil weight money is reserved, and it is for class size reduction, but there are no mandatory class size numbers. Madam Chair, just a couple other things on pupil enrollment. As the members of this committee are probably real familiar with, we're a very, very unique state. We're very varied. We have 48 school districts in the metro area that comprise 53% of the student population. We have another almost 300 school districts in the other 80 counties that are spread out all through the state. On 3.18, you can see that distribution by region. And then on 3.19, you can see how those regions have suffered enrollment declines during the past 5 years, from 2007 back to 2003. And you can see that all of the state, except for the East Central region, has had some decline over that period. Every economic development region of the state, except the East Central region, which is where Representative Erickson's from, that sort of band across the northern suburbs and around to the west a bit, has had declining enrollment. So even though the overall enrollment, if you go back to that chart, you could see was fairly flat out into the future, it masks some real decline in the northwest, northeast, and southwest parts of the state. But even in the seven-county metro area, there's been some decline in enrollment in the last couple of years. Finally, then, on the last note for you on pupil distribution, again, not only do we have a geographic variation in the state with our 340 school districts, but we also have some tremendous size variations. We have a few very large school districts in the state, and we have many, many, many very small school districts and many very small charter schools. The chart on page 320 divides school districts into five quintiles and shows of equal number of school districts and shows the relative population of those in terms of students. So the smallest districts, the smallest 69 school districts, comprise 2% of the students. The next smallest is about 5%. So between the 40% of the smallest school districts in the state, that's only about 7% of the kids. Haas, in the next quintile, pardon me, you're up to 60% of the kids and still, or 60% of the districts and still less than 15% of the kids. So really we have a very uneven distribution of kids among school districts. And even when you get to that last quintile, the 68 largest school districts, there are about a dozen school districts with more than 15,000 kids that make up the vast number of that. And then the other 50 or so districts get fairly small fairly quick. So even though the average school size in Minnesota, if you took the total number of students and divided by the number of kids, it'd be a number around 2,000. Very few of you have a district like that. Nearly all of you have much smaller or much larger districts than that.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, could you tell us, back on 319, 318, talking about enrollment, is there someplace that we're going to get to the numbers, the number of kids? They got percentages here.
Mr. Strom.
We sort of boiled down, believe it or not, boiled down what's in here. We're happy to provide you any of the detail you want. So if you want to see actual enrollment by numbers, you can do that. In the school finance guide, if you turn to the, I think, about 10 pages in there, there's a chart of enrollment on page 6 of the blue guidebook, and that lists enrollment from 1960 forward. So if you want to see the actual numbers there, if you go to page 6 of your blue guidebook, you can find them there.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, just talk a little bit in general again about state aid for schools. We'll talk about the percent that's funded by the state versus local levies. Beginning on with the chart on page 322, if you look at that chart, you see that, you know, for most of the history of what's on this chart from 1984 even into 1999 or 2000, the percent of school funding from state sources stayed pretty constant at around 60%. And you can see it started to climb in the early 2000s when the legislature made a concerted effort to buy down a variety of school property taxes. But the significant jump occurred in fiscal 2003 with the 2001 legislature's reform of the property tax system by elimination of the general education levy and a shift of referendum levy, about $415 per pupil of referendum levy onto the general formula, which basically reduced the property taxes that were being raised for operating referendums. And that raised that percentage almost to 90%. But since that time, with a combination of a couple of things, one being growth in tax base, reducing the amount of state aid provided under our equalized formulas, and in addition, the passage of additional operating referendums that were funded with local levies, you see that state share is dropping and projected to continue to drop through 2009, back down below the 80% level. We'll give you some detail later on about what's happening specifically on referendums, but that's a big part of what's driving that percentage down over time. The next chart on 323 goes back to the idea of how much of the state budget is used for education spending, and this does include early childhood spending. But if you look there, for the most part during the recent past, the last 6 years, basically tied in again to that fiscal 2003 buy-off of education levies. It was about $1 billion. The education, E-12 education, has accounted for about 40% of the state budget. You do see a bit of a blip in fiscal year 2006. That was the year we spent about $600 million buying off some of the property tax shifts that occurred in the 2003 session for 2005 and 6. And so kind of one-time spending to buy off accounting changes, not really reflective of kind of a commitment to education funding. So the real number for that year is also around 40%. And you can see it drops a bit in 2009. And that's because of enrollment trends, and education spending is relatively flat. Most of the other parts of the budget are relatively flat, except for the human services budget, which is projected to rise. So that's kind of eating into the share of the pie that used to be education when you look at baseline projections for 2009. And again, that can change depending on what happens this year as you set your appropriations. 324 has a lot of data on it and a really small print, and some people say unreadable, but I thought I'd throw it in there. That's the chart where the percent state share line is distilled from. It's about the, if you look at the bolded lines, it's about the fourth from the bottom, percent state, percent local. You can see kind of long-term history of what state appropriations have been. State credits are appropriations, but we count them as aid versus counting them under the levy because they're credits that reduce levies. Then you see the levies and dedicated funds and shift adjustments, and then at the bottom some calculations on a per-pupil basis. And you can feel free to peruse that and ask us any questions about it that you'd like. But I'd like to move on to page 325 and get back a bit to the big picture on education spending. Total revenue for fiscal year 2008, now this would include both aid, state aid and local property tax levies, is a little over $8 billion for that 1 year. When you're talking or thinking about the money you appropriate, the revenues that you have an impact on, it's important to remember what this pie looks like, because the bulk of the money that you allocate comes in the general education program. About 70% of the revenue that school districts receive is in the general education program. We'll talk in detail about that in a minute as well, but basically that's the basic formula, makes up the bulk of it, and then all of the other general education formulas such as compensatory, sparsity, anything, any of those, and we won't get into a lot of detail about them, but that's the biggest piece of the money that you allocate. The next largest piece comes in facilities and technology, and the bulk of that is voter-approved debt levies. And then the other two big pieces are special programs, which is special education funding, and referendum, which is the voter-approved operating referendums. So when you're thinking about what you have, what you can do and where you can put money or where you need to look at you know, what districts are getting, those are the big pieces. And they're very large. And so sometimes if you're thinking about some little program, it really isn't a big impact on the overall budget. So just remember, you're talking about really big money, really big dollar amounts. Okay. when you're thinking about some
could
of these.
Could you explain what education excellence is as well?
Madam Chair, I will, and we'll get in. I'll show you in detail in Section 4. But education, this is kind of a function of how we appropriate. We have different articles in the education finance bill. The first article is general education, and then it proceeds through different articles. Special ed is an article, facilities is an article. One of your articles is called education excellence. Obviously all of this money contributes to education excellence, but there's a subcategory of programs that is called education excellence. It's mostly a historical kind of title, but it includes things like charter school spending, integration programs, some of the Indian education programs, the relatively small amount of all-day kindergarten funding we have, some of those things, and I'll point that out in detail when we get to Section 4.
Representative Anzell.
Madam Chair, on the pie chart you used the term special programs, and back on 316 I see the word disabled used with pre-kindergarten and kindergarten. Are those terms interchangeable, and if so, what is the trend line in terms of percentages on a statewide level?
Mr. Crump.
Madam Chair and Representative Anzell, the definition on 316, I think it was, is a definition in statute of a pupil weight we use for students with disabilities. And so they're connected, but they really aren't the same thing, because special programs are the specific appropriations we make for special education, and there's about 10 of those programs that fit under there, but that's a pupil weight that actually plays into all of the funding formulas that are based on how we count kids. So if a student falls into that category of funding, they will generate funding throughout the whole funding system because their pupil weight is higher, versus the special programs, which is a cost base. The biggest piece of it is special ed, which is a cost based formula based on how much districts are spending on special education programs.
And we will have a whole hearing to clarify that, and probably more, because we'll probably have a lot of bills on special ed with the funding deficiencies that we have. But we'll kind of have a historical overview of how that's developed in our state and what are the funding needs. So that will help a lot. Representative Anzell.
Madam Chair, thank you for explaining that with a smile.
This is one of those committees where we are always learning. Our learning is cumulative, and what you don't understand today, you'll have another hearing to find out even more about and be so clarified. Mr. Crow.
Well, Madam Chair, just one other point about that, and we'll get to this with the special ed discussion, but almost all of our special ed funding is not done through pupil weighting. Some states do use a pupil weighting system, but the only pupils we weight differently for special education purposes are those that otherwise are either kindergarten or pre-kindergarten and wouldn't count for regular weighting. So because we have a mandate to serve those kids, we do put them in the pupil count, unlike a non-special needs student who's below the age of kindergarten would not count for any pupil weighting. So, but for most of our special ed programs, it's a categorical, and it's not done through the pupil weighting.
And Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, is this a good ending point, or did you have one more one-minute point you wanted to get in?
We've got a couple more charts to go through here that would, on the revenue, that may be a good ending point.
Okay, Christine.
Go through those.
Madam Chair and members and Representative Anzo, we have to say do a lot of this with a smile because, and you know, and we can say it's not our fault because you guys did it. So.
And they will.
So, Madam Chair and members, the next set of charts, 327 through 330, are a set of charts that describe total revenue, and I like to say that these, we talk about these because a lot of times school districts will come to the legislature and say, we don't have any money. Legislators will say, we gave you a lot of money. And sometimes we like to use these charts as a way to explain how both of those things can be true and how, from two different perspectives, you can see the same money two different ways. And you want to go through them in detail?
Sure. And Madam Chair, I get suckered into helping train the new school board members twice a year, and I was over there this morning, and these charts work perfectly to balance the day, because it really is what I tell them on 3.27 is what legislators see, and for good reason, because that's exactly what happens around here. That chart shows that in 1984, slightly under $3 billion of funding went for education, and in 2004, more than $8 billion of state aid was going out the door for school district revenue. And then if you look at the inflation-adjusted numbers using the CPI, you can see that that's been an increase every year nearly. If you turn the page and look at that on a per-pupil or per-student basis, you can see the same thing there, going from about $4,000 to over $10,000 per pupil in terms of revenue for school districts. And on an inflation-adjusted basis, there's a couple places where that line gets pretty flat, but generally speaking, that line is increasing over time. And when I talk to the school board members, I tell them that this is the picture the legislature sees. And that's exactly right, because what you're seeing is this budget in context of the other things we showed you in those pie charts. You're allocating money to K-12 instead of to higher ed or instead of to health and human services or to other types of tax relief. And so it's all a big picture to you. You're spending increasing amounts of money on schools. But then if you make a couple adjustments to that, which the next two charts show, you get a picture that the school board members have imprinted in their minds. And the first of these charts on 3.29 says, okay, we'll take that revenue per student, but factor out two things that really don't matter for the regular classroom. Factor out the amount that districts have spent on new buildings and building repairs to meet new state mandates over the last 30 years. And you can see that that line starts to flatten out. And then if you take out the money that's spent on special education as well, you can see that it goes from somewhere under $4,000 to less than $8,000. And if you turn the page to 330, and this is where we can leave you today if you want. I guess we've got one other page after this. But if you turn to 330 and look at the dotted line there, for those of you that used to be school board members, that's the picture that's in your head, that dotted line on the bottom. What's the legislature done for you lately? Well, if you look at that, you see that since 1984 all the way up to 2004, that's a pretty darn flat line. So if a school district is thinking, well, what can we do to change our class size, or what can we do to add new curriculum, or what can we do change the technology that's in the classroom, all those kinds of things, the relative amount that's been in the regular classroom on a per-student basis really hasn't changed all that much over time. Both of those pictures, the top line on that first graph and the bottom line on this last graph, are absolutely true. They tell a real story. But a lot of it is perspective, and a lot of it explains why there seems to be such a disconnect when you fight as hard as you do for more money for schools and go home and your local school board members say, well, what did you do for us? That's why that comes about. And I think it's important to understand that, because that really drives a lot of the miscommunication that happens about whether we're adequately funding our schools or not. The answer to that question, I think, really is it depends.
Thank you very much. We'll continue this tomorrow, but first there's one staff member that I forgot to introduce, and he's in the audience. Steve Harding, if you could just raise your hand. He will be covering our committee, actually, I'm told, every single time we meet for Session Weekly, which is our weekly publication. So he will be helping to explain all this to the public, right?
That's right.
All right. Thank you. We'll see you this time tomorrow. We adjourn.